Have some great plans for this year with a total of 4 events devoted to celebrating our 40th anniversary and to thank our supporters who have been helping us for the last 40 years. And we want to make sure that our legacy in the community is bright into the future and hope that you will join us into the future as well. We hope you will check our website, which actually lists our programs that are upcoming as well as the events for the 40th anniversary, and also check out our monthly newsletters to see what's going on. You can also follow us on social media to learn more about the exciting things happening this year. Before we begin the program, ICFRC wants to acknowledge and thank its annual donors, our sponsors, and partners for their support. This list includes the Iowa Arts Council through the Iowa Department of Cultural Affairs, Humanities Iowa and the National Endowment for the Humanities, the University of Iowa's International Programs, Honors Program, and the Public Policy Center, the Stanley U of I Foundation Support Organization, Midwest One Bank, Taxes Plus, City Channel 4 for providing online access to ICFRC's program along with the U of I Library Archives, the Iowa City Public Library, which is our new home, and we're so happy to be here too. And last but certainly not least, the long-standing support from individuals who have helped our organization grow for the last 40 years. Many of who are in the audience today, both in person as well as online. I want to let you know that the Iowa City Foreign Relations Council has adopted the Native American Land Acknowledgement prepared for the City of Iowa City's Ad Hoc Truth and Reconciliation Commission and the Human Rights Commission. ICFRC recognizes that our home community of Iowa City now occupies the homeland of Native American nations to whom we owe our commitment and dedication. The full text of ICFRC's acknowledgement is on our website at icfrc.org. Now I would like to introduce our speaker. Amy Erica Smith is an associate professor of political science as well as a liberal arts and sciences dean's professor at Iowa State University. She is also currently an Andrew Carnegie Fellow. Professor Smith's research examines how ordinary people understand and engage in politics, from Latin America to Kenya to Oman. She is the author of 3 books and numerous articles, and her research has been recognized with awards including the Fulbright, the Luce Foundation, the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, and the National Science Foundation. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Smith, who will talk about, is Brazil at a tipping point, democracy and climate change? Welcome, Dr. Smith.
Thank you, Janet. I'm so happy to be here. Welcome from the other side, from the other university, one of the other 2 major universities in the state. So I'm really happy to be here with you all. This is the second time I've gotten to be here at the ICFRC. I was here 4 years ago before a pandemic and an entire lifetime ago. Wanted to start off by talking about, democracy and climate change is the topic of this talk. These are things that I have spent a very, very long time studying in Brazil. We're going to be spending a fair amount of time focusing on the Brazilian environment, which I have been doing a fair amount of research on recently, especially with respect to how social groups interact with the environment. But I wanted to start off first by talking a little bit about how political scientists understand democracy. So when I teach a class in Introduction to Comparative Politics, I say that many of us, seems especially high schoolers today, are taught that the US is a republic, not a democracy. That I hear this often from my students, that we, and that a true democracy would be one, say an Athenian democracy, where people get together and congregate. This may be one vision of democracy, but the truth is that scholars recognize many, many different visions of democracy. And what we conceptualize as democracy today in the United States is, and in political science, is a something that's a representative form of government that involves people electing those who those who will represent them, who will make laws, as well as meaningful mechanisms for interaction between citizens and their government. So some way for citizens to channel feedback to government and for government to be held accountable. So not just elections, elections plus a whole bunch of other things. So we say that democracy, scholars of comparative politics, those of us who study democracy in different places around the world, we say that democracy travels in waves, has gone in waves. There's a famous guy, Samuel Huntington, who's known for a bunch of controversial books, but one of his least controversial sort of pieces of work is about how democracy travels in waves around the world. And democracy has... the United States itself actually was a harbinger of the first wave of democratization, of modern day democratization in the world, though the democracy that was established in the United States in 1776 was far from, or 1789, was far from a perfect democracy and was not what we would call a democracy today at all, but it was ostensibly under some democratic rules. So we have a first wave of democratization that lasted a very long time. Then we had a few other subsequent waves of democracy, culminating actually in a wave of democracy. This is where it becomes relevant for the talk, culminating in what we call a third wave of democracy that rolled across Latin America in beginning in the late 1970s, early 1980s. So Brazil had been a military dictatorship for from 1964 through 1985. And in 1985, Brazil had a transition to democracy. And I'm about to show you a really important dude, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, who was important in that transition. So Brazil transitioned to democracy in 1985, elected its first president. So the transition president was not actually elected. They had a, sort of an interim period. So they elected its first democratic president in the new democratic era in 1988, adopted a new constitution in 1989, and the rest is history. We have not had a reversion to authoritarianism since, though there's a lot of scholarship that suggests that the world has had a democratic recess, a minor episode of democratic backsliding in which many countries all at once have had a reverse wave of what we would call autocratization or movement towards authoritarianism in the past decade or so. So democracy has traveled in waves across the globe and including in Brazil. Why does it travel in waves? That's a question for another day. But there's things about countries influencing each other, moments of time, historical junctures, world wars that influence a whole bunch of countries all at once. Okay, so this guy, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, was a major union leader in the later years of the military dictatorship, major union organizer, and has run for president in every presidential election since Brazil, or tried to run for president. That's a long story that I'll get to in a moment. Has either run for president or come very close to running for president in every election since Brazil redemocratized in 1988, or had one of his hand-chosen successors run for re-election. So this guy, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, here he is as a union organizer in his 30s. He is among his background is kind of extraordinary. He's a larger-than-life political figure. He was born into abject poverty in the Brazilian Northeast, was illiterate as a child. I mean, like, he gained his literacy as an adult in labor unions. He never went to school as a young child, ended up working in factories very young. So his family migrated from the Brazilian Northeast to São Paulo State and lived in the... In Latin America, what we call the suburbs are not fancy, posh suburbs. These are like rural slums on the outskirts of cities. So lived in slums on the outskirts of the city of São Paulo and worked his way up through union organizing to become one of the most famous politicians in the entire world. So Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, here he is, sometime in the 1980s, union organizing. He went on. So as I said, he ran for president every single presidential election for a really long time. Ultimately was finally elected president during a period in which he sort of moderated his discourse. He'd been very leftist. He moderated his discourse, came sort of towards the center. There was a lot of Democratic opening. He was finally elected president in 2000 and ended up becoming a politician whom Barack Obama once called the most popular politician on the planet. He had astronomically high approval ratings, approval ratings like in the 90s. People loved him. He was charismatic. He had this sort of popular feel. He was good at talking to ordinary people. So Brazil had a two-term limit for the presidency. So he was elected in 2000, finished his second term in 2008. He was elected in 2000, ended up leaving the presidency in 2008, and then 2010. In 2010, he left, that's what it was. He had a five-year term, and then it was decreased to a four-year term, doing the math. Yeah, so he left office in 2010. In 2010, he was so extremely popular still. He was so very popular that he was able to elect his hand-chosen successor, a woman named Dilma Rousseff. He managed to elect his hand-chosen successor, Dilma Rousseff, who came into office and had a difficult time in office, ultimately would be impeached. So we have this man who has this extraordinary trajectory from abject poverty into the presidency. He elects his hand-chosen successor. He basically controls Brazilian politics in some sense up until his hand-chosen successor, Dilma Rousseff, is impeached in 2016. So here he is in 2018 running for the presidency again. In the presidential election of 2018, his hand-chosen successor, Dilma Rousseff, who had just been impeached in a story that I will tell you in a minute, she had just been impeached and he was himself under criminal investigation for corruption. Ultimately, he was disqualified for running in the 2018 presidential election due to what many people believe were trumped up. Actually, it's pretty, the evidence is very clear at this point, that there were something of manufactured and manipulated evidence that would enable him to be disqualified from the presidential election. It is entirely conceivable that he was guilty of some of the crimes of which he was committed, but there was a lot of backdoor dealing and maneuvering in order to get him disqualified from the presidential election of 2018. So here he is contesting his charges in 2018. And we go from, so within the following years, ultimately the trial in which he was imprisoned before ever being able to actually get onto the ballot, though he would have probably won the 2018 presidential election if he had made it onto the ballot. But so he ultimately, that trial was thrown out, his conviction was thrown out, and he gets his political rights back, his right to run for office back, which brings us to 2022, when he runs for the presidency again and is back in power. So as when he returns to power when he's reelected in 2022, after this amazing political trajectory, he is invited to speak at the United Nations even before before taking office, because presidents are inaugurated on January 1st of the year after their election in Brazil. So even before taking office, he's invited to speak at the United Nations, and he announces Brazil has returned. Brasil votou. So here he is at the end of this amazing trajectory. I also want to talk, because this is a talk also about the environment and political changes in Brazil, about a different person, Marina Silva. Marina doesn't have quite the length of history of Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, but is also in her own right, really an extraordinary politician whose story also tells something of the story of Brazil. So she was raised in the Amazon rainforest as a very young rural worker, as a girl herself in labor union, and worked her way up as likewise through labor union organizing. In her 20s, she becomes very ill, has a goes through a miracle healing, and converts to Pentecostalism, to the Universal Church of the Kingdom of God. So her religious story is a really interesting one that a lot of people don't tell about her. But I happen to be a scholar of religion and politics, and so I think her story of conversion is a particularly interesting one, and also tells a piece of the rapid religious transformation that's happened in Brazil, with widespread conversion from Catholicism to evangelicalism and Pentecostalism. She's also, of course, an interesting example of a leftist Pentecostal, which is more common in Brazil than in the United States. So she rises into politics eventually. Lula's 77, she's in her 60s. So she rises into politics eventually. She ends up not being as wildly successful politically as Lula, but does ultimately end up working for his administration in his first term as his environment minister. As the environment minister, she oversees a rapid decrease, or relatively rapid, and sustained. I think sustained is more important than rapid. So over the course of about 12 years or so, she and the governments that she influences managed to substantially decrease rates of deforestation of the Amazon. They do this basically by fining people who deforest. So the laws governing the Amazon in Brazil are fairly strict and often not enforced. So there are pretty clear rules about setting aside land or territory for, what percentage of your land can be farmed or used or deforested, what percentage has to be preserved. These laws are frequently entirely ignored. And the other problem that happens is that there's a lot of illegal trafficking in land, and also just illegal land grabs. What we would call illegal land grabs, or what Brazilians call grilagem, is extremely common and is responsible for a very large portion of what's happening in terms of deforestation in the Amazon. So a side anecdote, one of my favorite words in the Portuguese language is the word grilagem, which means literally cricketing. So the term is used to refer to the practice of falsifying your papers to your title to your land. So you, if you manufacture false papers, at least historically, I don't think people actually do this anymore. I'm not sure when people actually did this. But historically, you would like manufacture these false papers and then put them in a box with a bunch of crickets, let the crickets do their business on the papers, and take them out and they would be weathered, look weathered. So grilagem is sort of a method of falsifying papers to land, and is a very frequent tool for illegal land grabs. Illegal land invasion. So basically, some of this is about creating new laws, but a lot of what she does is simply about enforcing laws and what the administration does. So Brazil hits its lowest point of deforestation ever in 2012 under her influence. She's no longer the environmental minister, but she sort of the programs that she sets in place end up ultimately having this effect. And then things start to go badly after that. We have economic decline, we have the troubles within the Dilma Rousseff administration and things like that. So anyway, she had this really important period. She ends up running for president a few times herself, is less successful than Lula, at some point becomes sort of a political rival of Lula for all sorts of internal infighting reasons, and now is back again as the environment minister. I couldn't find as dramatic sort of before and after photos of her, but so she is now back as of the beginning of 2023. So Lula returned, Brazil returned, and Marina Silva is now back on the national stage. And the first half of spoiler alert, the first half of 2023 saw a really dramatic decline in deforestation in the Amazon, which is not to say these trends will continue. There are all kinds of things that influence them, but there is it's some success. So the other part of the story, though, to go backwards a little bit, is this woman, Dilma Josefi. So this woman, Dilma Josefi, was the hand-picked successor of Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, or Lula, in 2010. She's elected in 2010 and re-elected in 2014. When she's re-elected in 2014, she is already at the beginning of a major corruption scandal. As she is being re-elected, she's re-elected by a fairly narrow margin, and news is breaking as she's being elected that will ultimately become a major scandal called Operation Car Wash, for the car wash where they were more or less laundering money. So she ends up eventually being impeached for a whole bunch of different reasons, but ostensibly for corruption. And leaves office. And this is when we get this guy, Jair Bolsonaro, rising into office. So she's impeached in 2016. And in 2016, we have an interim president, her vice president, who actually turned on her and was instrumental in manipulating or orchestrating the her ouster. So we have... So in 2016, we have an interim president, Michel Temer, who is extremely unpopular. Nobody likes him. He's not a charismatic politician. He's not the kind of person who would run for president, and he's not going to run for president. The field is wide open because Lula has been removed from office or removed from running for the presidency in 2018. So there's a relatively less known politician, Fernando Haddad, who ends up running as the major candidate from the Workers' Party on the left, and on the right, it's an open field. In this context, this guy, Jair Bolsonaro, rises into power. He is, this picture here is showing him with a really emblematic hand signal that he uses. So I think Brazilian society is less tolerant of gun ownership than is U.S. society. And in the Brazilian political and sort of social culture, this kind of hand signal was perceived as really, or hand sign was perceived as really violent and aggressive and problematic when he was running for office. But he made this sort of his political thing. He was... gun ownership had not been a major political issue in Brazil. It had been highly, highly restricted, and it was just not something people were mostly concerned about until the mid-2010s, when there started to be some movement. But he really brought the issue of gun ownership to the fore and pushed loosening of gun laws. He runs for office. He had been a minor politician from the state of Rio, not so minor. He had been a politician. He had been a federal deputy. So he had been elected to the National Congress from the state of Rio de Janeiro, but not a particularly important member of Congress. He didn't have many political allies. He didn't have much of a national profile. Very few people knew who he was. When his name started to be whispered in 2016, this guy could actually win the presidential election. And actually, 2016 or so, as Donald Trump was winning, people started to say, oh, there could be a far-right takeover in Brazil as well. Then ultimately in 2018, he ends up running. He was known when he was running for office. He was known for all sorts of controversial statements. So as he was running for office, there were these publications. You could find all of these lists of controversial things that Jair Bolsonaro said. So these are among the controversial things that he had said that were publicized in national media. He had once told a female deputy that he wouldn't rape her because she didn't deserve it. And when questioned about it, he said, I wouldn't rape her because she's ugly. She's not my type. I would never rape her. He said things like, I wouldn't employ women and men with the same salary. He was a major defender of the of Brazil's military dictatorship up through that was in power up through the mid-1980s. Dilma Rousseff, his predecessor, who had been impeached, had herself actually been a something of a communist fighter, a guerrilla fighter, in southern Brazil, in the state of Porto Alegre. And she had been herself arrested and tortured under the military regime, and had he was brother. I mean, he was very open in sort of lauding the torture of Dilma Rousseff and of people like her during the military regime. When he voted to impeach Dilma Rousseff, he dedicated his vote to the impeachment. He made a speech in which he dedicated his vote to the impeachment to her torturer. He said, you know, some pretty homophobic things. So, yeah, he's known for saying lots of pretty offensive things. So this is a guy who ends up getting elected president in 2018 in a period where there's extreme political disillusionment and really a crisis of the entire political system in which Dilma Rousseff had been impeached, Lula da Silva had been removed from office, removed from running for office, and things went on. And then traditional parties of the right also were unable to field a respectable candidate or a candidate with good chances. So Jair Bolsonaro's history, I think I'm going to go really quickly over this given our time, but Jair Bolsonaro's history was an interesting one. He had risen to power through, or his trajectory into office had been initially through the military. He had been a young man, as a young man, he had entered the military fairly early under the military dictatorship, had risen to the ranks of colonel, but he, during the transition to democracy, Brazil went through a period of hyperinflation, and military salaries, like salaries for everybody else, plummeted. He started rabble-rousing within the military to protest low salaries. So his rabble-rousing was perceived as insurrection or insubordination. So he was a rabble rouser. He published an op-ed in a major national magazine, complaining about how military salaries were too low. And as a result of all of this, he comes to the attention of his commanding officers, who are not very happy with him. Ultimately, what gets him almost dishonorably discharged from the military, and it's changed at the last minute, is developing a plot to bomb some military installations in protest. This gets leaked to a reporter, or actually he leaks it to a reporter. He wasn't very politically savvy, but he ends up accidentally or just talking about his plans to a reporter who tells her it's off the record, and she ends up publishing it. So his plans to bomb the military installation get published in a major national publication. He is court-martialed and tried, and there is such an upswell from within the lower ranks of the military. There are all of these people sending letters to the military judges to defend him, to express their support for him, and the judges ultimately let him off, saying that they can't recognize the handwriting on his plans. Yeah, despite the fact that this has been published in a major national publication. So he's ultimately let off the hook in the 1980s and is told to leave the military quietly. So he continues to hold the rank, or well, he continues to claim the rank of colonel. And in any case, so this is the, he has a history of both very strong ties to the military and some insubordination that ultimately becomes very politically salient around 2023. He this is a good ticket for him into running for office. He starts running for city council. His defense, his popularity within the lower ranks of the military, he becomes a candidate of the armed forces. And in Brazil, the police are considered part of the armed forces. So he has very strong representation within the police forces, which are themselves have themselves a lot of problems with corruption and impunity. So he has very strong support within the police and within the military. So when he's running for office, there are all of these, all of this discussion in the national media about how he is a threat to democracy. Ultimately, when he's elected in this extraordinary political time, he Scott Mainwaring, who's a very important scholar of Latin American politics at the at Harvard University, or he was at Harvard at the time, said, this is a really radical shift. I can't think of a more extremist leader in the history of democratic elections in Latin America who has actually gotten elected. Stephen Levitsky, another really important political scientist at Harvard, said, it's much more likely that Brazilian democracy will die at the hands of an elected leader because Jair Bolsonaro was elected. So we have lots of, so this is the day of his inauguration. We have people, supporters in the streets celebrating his inauguration. Okay, so Jair Bolsonaro's term coincides with worsening deforestation. Jair Bolsonaro did not cause the beginnings. As I said, 2012 was a trough in deforestation, was the lowest point in deforestation. Deforestation had started to increase in the ensuing years for reasons that have nothing to do with Jair Bolsonaro, obviously, including changes in the economy and loosening of laws and basically increasing power of agribusiness. And so agribusiness has often been driving deforestation in Brazil. But during Jair Bolsonaro's presidency, it dramatically increases. We also have the arrival of increasingly important scientific warnings that Brazil could be approaching a tipping point. So this is a picture from 2020 of drought all across much of what we call the Southern Cone, which is southern Brazil, Argentina, and Chile. We have had recurring droughts in Latin America across. There have been major areas of South America in drought more or less continuously since about 2013. Different places at different times, but we have had rolling droughts across different places. And we have, during his term, increasing warnings from scientists that Brazil could be approaching, or specifically the Brazilian Amazon, could be approaching a tipping point. So what does a tipping point mean in terms of deforestation? So rainforests produce their own moisture. A rainforest, the exhalation of moisture from trees will lead to convection currents that produce rain. But there reaches a point where trees are, there is little enough old growth left, and new growth is less effective at maintaining these currents. So, and that enough has been deforested, there's been enough disruption to the ecosystems, that this process of rainforests actually producing their own rain ends, and rainforests will start to dry themselves out. So the best estimates are that somewhere between 20 and 25%, at 20 to 25% total deforestation of the Amazon will reach a tipping point. So what happens when it reaches a tipping point? There's a process that's called savannization, movement change into a savanna, where the ecosystem will basically start to change. And then a new process will set in which trees will start to, there will not be sufficient rain to maintain the forest that's in place right now. So this kind of thing has already happened in other forests of South America. So across the Atlantic, across the Atlantic coast, we once had a major rainforest which was gradually deforested from the 1600s onward. There are very small pockets of it remaining today. In Rio de Janeiro, if you see beautiful trees, those beautiful trees are part of what was once the Atlantic rainforest. So the Atlantic rainforest is something like 98% deforested. Much of the major metropolises of Brazil and of South America are in what was once the Atlantic rainforest. So the Atlantic rainforest has already gone through this process, and this could happen as well to the Amazon, which is a much larger and more important, globally important forest than the Amazon rainforest was. Scary possibility. If this happens, one estimate found that one attempt to simulate the impact of removing the Amazon found that removing the Amazon by itself would lead to a global temperature rise of 0.25 degrees C and could lead to localized rise in temperature by about 4.5 degrees C. So that's a lot. That's a lot for the people living in the region. Not to mention that, as we're seeing this year, the deforestation of the Amazon is contributing to a, not deforestation, drought. There's currently drought in the Amazon, which is leading to rapid drop in water levels. The drop in the water levels is similar to what many of you may know is happening on the Mississippi right now with trouble with barges and shipping and transportation. The problem is that the Amazon region actually is incredibly dependent on its rivers for transportation, much more, say, than we are on the Mississippi. So we have places that are effectively unreachable, except by boat. Many places, many populated human populations that are almost unreachable, except by boat. I mean, you could fly there. Nobody can fly. I mean, nobody has the money to fly. So the roads are almost non-existent in many of these places. The loss of this could be pretty catastrophic for much of northern Brazil. And similar processes can also occur throughout the other countries of the nine-country Amazon region. Other research shows that this kind of thing, obviously this kind of thing drives all kinds of things like population flows across the world. Studies show that climate vulnerability is greatest in the poorest countries of the world. Climate change risk is greatest in the lowest countries of the world. So that's what this here shows. Some political science evidence suggests that climate change is contributing to violence in places like the Middle East. It's also contributing to population flows, migration from Latin America up to the north. So really important problems. So there are major questions about, have we reached Brazil's tipping point? So this is a photo from this year. Interesting tidbit about the Brazilian Amazon River is that Brazilians say that the Amazon is two different rivers. Below the city of Manaus is the Amazon River, and above the city of Manaus is the Solimões. This has become kind of controversial. There are people who want to call it all one river because it sounds bigger. You can call it a longer river if you give it all one name. So this is the Rio Solimões. At a level which is making boats impassable or nearly impassable. The other part of this is that after a relatively uneventful, though highly conflictual, presidential term, Jair Bolsonaro leaves office. Ultimately, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva is elected president in 2022, as I'd said. At the same point, when Bolsonaro leaves office, his supporters, right after Bolsonaro has left office, his supporters storm the Brazilian capital in protest against Lula taking office. So it is an eerily parallel reference to the storming of the U.S. Capitol on January 6th. So this happens on January 8th, 2023. The U.S. Capitol is stormed on January 6th, 2021. This was a deliberate historical reference, surely. His supporters are strong supporters of President Trump as well. And Jair Bolsonaro is maybe Trump's biggest fan. His family are some of Trump's biggest fans. So there's a very strong sort of echo that is deliberate. That said, people had sort of politics watchers, pundits had been expecting that something like this could happen at any point. It wasn't a surprise that it happened because there were lots of disgruntled Bolsonaristas, as they're called, all around who were pretty upset we're going to have some kind of issue. But at some point on January 8th, there was a security lapse. There have been lots of investigations, some serious sort of recriminations and self-examination that's happened within the military and within the security services to understand how these security lapses happened on January 8th that ultimately enabled this demonstration to become a massive insurrection that trashed, sacked government buildings, sacked major works of art, and things like that. So have we reached Brazil's tipping points? It's unclear. I am much, much more optimistic about politics. On the political side, I think Brazil has not reached a democratic. I am confident in saying that Brazil has not reached a democratic tipping point. Where are we on the environment is less clear. So when Lula came back to office, he's gone from that labor union leader we saw in the first photo to this guy right here speaking. This is him speaking at COP27 last year. He was invited to speak at COP27 at the Climate of Parties, the UN Climate Change Negotiations Summit. So he was invited to speak at the UN Climate Change Negotiations Summit before being president in Jair Bolsonaro's place. There is something like a snub here, except that Jair Bolsonaro would not have gone anyway. So there was no point inviting him. So Lula goes in Jair Bolsonaro's place before being inaugurated and speaks, and he says, Brazil has returned. O Brasil está de volta. Which becomes a massive slogan. He uses this, I actually should have put these are in reverse temporal order. So he says this in November before being inaugurated, and then the expression Brazil is back becomes this sort of slogan for his administration. He has publicity that says Brazil is back. This is this particular one is an image, like a meme created that his administration created to celebrate his 100th day, the accomplishments of his first 100 days. And he's still using that expression in public discourse. He used the phrase, he kicked off his speech at the United Nations General Assembly a few weeks ago using the same phrase. So yes, Brazil has returned. What has Brazil returned to? Brazil has returned to climate change negotiations with full force. It's returned to the international arena, international negotiations of all kinds in full force. Lula has always been a major statesman and been highly valued his role as a statesman, and has very strong opinions about foreign policy that are sometimes substantially disaligned from the U.S. He is right now at odds with a lot of people in the U.S., but he is out there diplomatically a lot. It has returned to trying to stop deforestation. And politics is suddenly working again. A lot of politics kind of ground to a halt under Jair Bolsonaro because, like, ordinary sort of legislation. He has managed to pass a really ambitious legislative agenda within his first 9 months in office. Tax reform that hadn't been passed in 2 decades suddenly got passed. So there's a lot that is back, actually. Where are we in terms of deforestation? The deforestation question, I mean, climate change continues. Drought this year, the Amazon region is seeing what is likely to ultimately be its worst drought ever. We are still not at the end of the dry season, and the projections are that at the worst of the dry season, there will be communities that are entirely cut off because they're inaccessible. Communities of thousands of people who are entirely cut off from civilization. There is a lot of work left to do. So what can we do? What can be done? Brazil, the Lula administration is putting a lot of hope in international agreements. In general, Latin American environmentalists put a lot of hope in international efforts. International efforts help to provide, the support that is needed for local politicians to ask for things often, saying that we need these policies in order to get export beef to the EU, actually ends up being really politically important. And also money. I mean, ultimately what Lula is pushing for on the international scene when he's out there as a statesman, when I say he's out there as a statesman, he's out there as a statesman constantly asking for money. He is pushing for massive increases in funding for sustainable development, not the sustainable development goals, but goals of sustainable development. On the international scene, the world is not meeting, developed countries are not meeting their obligations, their commitments under the Paris Accords. He's pushing for developed countries to fund more. The U.S. has offered a very small amount of money to the Amazon Fund. He's pushing for more increases in the in funding. So what Lula would ask me to say is, give money, send money, please. In addition, there are all kinds of other things that can be done. There are lots of scientists and small organizations working on things like trying to develop what they call a standing forest economy that will, it is what it says, an economy, economic models, models of job creation that enable, that involve the forest standing. Okay, I have talked beyond the time that I intended to go. I am ready to take questions.
So as we move into the question and answer portion, for those of you who have a question here, please raise your hand. And I will come around with the microphone. We are recording this, so we want to make sure we have your question on the microphone so it's recorded. But before we begin with the questions, ICFRC wants to thank its supporters and donors for their support. And if you would like to join ICFRC or to make a gift for this program or our future programs, please go to icfrc.org. or check out any of the signs that are around that have a little QR code, and you can just get right on your phone and pay that way if you want. So thank you. So is there a question over here?
Valley. Is it even possible to carry out reforestation by planting new trees?
Yeah. Okay. I don't need a mic, right? Okay. Yes. So one of the things about the rainforest is it actually grows back naturally. Deforestation is a process that needs to be ongoing, which is not to say that people are not also reforesting. But yes, there are definitely efforts, all kinds of projects to reforest. There are also efforts to pay people for, there are various kinds of Red Plus initiatives, which are initiatives that are, Red Plus is an acronym that stands for reforesting, reforestation and environmental, I've entirely lost the acronym for the moment, but it is a UN funded, if you Google REDD Plus, you'll find that there's a major UN initiative that is about effectively paying poor people in communities to protect the land that they're on, and part of this definitely involves reforestation. Also, reforestation at present is not terribly difficult. Though what are you reforesting with? That's a good question, and that's something that people are working on very effectively. Right now, I mean, even in the deforested Atlantic rainforest, the Atlantic rainforest is constantly regrowing itself and has to be constantly deforested in the areas where it's been deforested. But yes, there are lots of plans for reforestation.
So I know there was the comparison made between Bolsonaro and Trump. Do you think that Bolsonaro will also attempt to be reelected in the future, or is he pretty much off the political field as of right now?
I don't actually think he's going to be reelected. He ultimately was not as popular a politician as Trump. He was not as successful as Trump. I think Brazilian political culture was also just actually less amenable to that kind of a far rightist than American political culture is, for reasons that would take too long for me to discuss. He presided over a presidency that was widely seen as somewhere between mediocre and poor. He was a massive COVID denialist, which actually was by most of the political establishment seen as just kind of being outside the norm and weird and not something we want to deal with, and definitely something to discourage. So there's a lot of discussion about how he presided over 700,000 COVID deaths. And that's sort of when people today talk about his presidency, they talk about Jair Bolsonaro, the guy who presided over 700,000 COVID deaths. He also he was a proponent of chloroquine, which is a malaria drug. So he got the idea, this sort of magical notion, that chloroquine, a malaria drug, was an anti-malarial, was the magic cure for COVID, and you didn't need any of the rest of the stuff, just take chloroquine, which, because Brazil is actually a malaria region, meant that he led to a shortage of malarial drugs for people who actually needed it. Though there was all of this attempt to like control the use of it because they didn't want it to go out of stock for people who were just like random people who were just taking it for no reason. So anyway, he did those kinds of things. He also now is the target of a few corruption investigations. It's conceivable some of you might have seen news stories about a jewelry scandal. His wife was given, while he was president, his wife, the first lady, received some very fancy jewelry from the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, which was state property and ended up getting sold, sold on the black market in Florida. And then when it was discovered, somebody went back and tried to buy it back, there's a lot of political ineptness there too. So it is conceivable he could actually go to prison for that, though political pundits are a little, iffy on whether he will actually end up going to prison. But there's a possibility he could go to prison. More likely, he's just not popular enough to win again. Or he is popular enough in certain circles that whoever runs on the right will seek his support, but he will not himself run.
Questions? So if agribusiness has been a big source of deforestation.
Yeah.
Is Lula making efforts to clamp down on deforestation by the agribusinesses and the big ranchers? And the second part of that question is, does the man on the street in Brazil see deforestation as a problem? Say, if you live in one of the cities, what are you thinking about deforestation?
Okay. Yeah, those are very different questions. So as far as what is he doing with respect to agribusiness? So agribusiness is incredibly powerful. He is not confronting agribusiness. What I would say is happening more is that environmentalists are trying to work with agribusiness to change the incentives of agribusiness. Agribusiness is about as politically, one of the most politically powerful groups in Brazil right now. Effectively, you can think of deforestation as ranging from there are very large internationally connected firms that are raising cattle and doing ranching and other kinds of agriculture. And then it ranges all the way to the smallest mom and pop. And deforestation is happening all across the board. You can change the incentives of the big internationally connected entities, which are also the most politically powerful ones, by doing things like changing the laws in Norway can change their practices in these huge ranches in the Brazil center west. Yes, there has been a lot of work on trying to change incentives and practices within these large, very large, internationally connected ranches and farms, plantations. And then ranging all the way down to the very small scale mom and pop, which are also engaging in deforestation and often actually engaging in illegal land grabs. So the small sort of off the books farms are often doing a lot of illegal land grabbing. They're being run on land that they do not legally own. And they're engaging in a lot of deforestation. So yeah, there we do get more of actual clamping down on the low-scale producer who is very much at the front lines of deforestation. And also trying to change incentives for people at that level too by, say, creating what they call a standing forest economy. As far as what the average Brazilian thinks, the average Brazilian on the streets of São Paulo would tell you that, São Paulo is the biggest city in Brazil. The average Brazilian on the streets of São Paulo would tell you that deforestation is awful, or at least this would be sort of what you learned in school, that deforestation is awful, that the Amazon is a patrimony, that it is like sort of a national treasure, a national resource that you need to value and that we should preserve. And this is what kids learn in school. There was some increasing politicization and polarization around this issue under Jair Bolsonaro because he made it an issue. But even so, there's still a lot of public opinion in the big cities, in places that aren't very strongly connected to the Amazon, that is supportive of Amazon protection. Also, you know, classes like for little children teach about biodiversity. They teach about, you know, the jaguars and the toucans and things like that. Kids grow up knowing that biodiversity is associated with the Amazon, and this is an important part of our national history and resources. As far as what the average Brazilian living in the Amazon thinks, there you get much more ambiguous. And the problem is that the deforestation is done by people living on the ground in the Amazon themselves. And there we have a lot of conflict. And there are many communities where the local economy is entirely dependent on deforestation. And so in those places, and sometimes there are entire communities where the entire community is on illegal land, illegally, like there is maybe a settlement of 30,000 people that is an illegal settlement on land that they don't own and that exists for extractive industries, whether deforestation, mining, sometimes illegal fishing, are all illegal agriculture to some extent, are all ongoing things happening in various protected places in the Amazon. And not surprisingly, the average citizen living in an illegal community that depends on deforestation is not supportive of ending deforestation. Yeah, yes.
I also have two questions. So my first one is on the political side. So do you think in Brazil you're going to have that same far-right political trend after Bolsonaro? Do you think his ineffectiveness as a politician is going to kind of call that? Or what's your opinion?
That's a really good question. I think the far right is going to continue to some extent. I think it is weakened. There will continue to be far right politicians, far right pundits. There is definitely a movement that has been created that is not going away anytime soon. It may not be able to win political office, at least the presidency again, for quite a while.
Okay. I was just curious if it would be like kind of mirroring America in that same sense. But my second question is how would ending deforestation, so what economies would replace that? What would replace that economy of deforestation?
What would be a standing forest economy? You're asking what are the industries?
What industry would the people that rely on deforestation, what would they go into to replace that economy?
Yeah. Have you heard of acai?
Briefly.
Okay, so acai is a fruit. It's a rainforest fruit that is actually harvested from standing trees in the rainforest. So one of the things people promoting a standing forest economy are focusing on is promoting acai. So things like that. There are all sorts of rainforest products. It turns out, actually, that the Amazon is not really a natural entity in some sense. I mean, it is natural, obviously. But the Amazon is itself a product of human agriculture. So the indigenous people were cultivating and farming and producing the biodiversity of the Amazon region for about 1,000 years before the Spanish and Portuguese ever arrived. And what we see what we know as the Amazon today, what appears to be an extraordinarily biodiverse place, actually humans increased the biodiversity of the Amazon region over the course of 1,000 years to make it more productive, what we could call at the time economically productive or useful for humans. So there are lots of things in the Amazon that could be exploited or used as economic products. I mean, there are all kinds of extracts and all kinds of things. Rubber tapping was very common in the Amazon. It's gone away, but things like that.
Yeah. Thank you. Any other questions?
Okay. Well, please join me again in thanking Dr. Smith for this excellent presentation.
Thank you. Thank you.
This is ICFRC's fifth program this fall. Our next program is featuring our 2023 Iowa Writers Program fall resident, Yakisha Graham, speaking about Jamaica, holding a vibe in a textured landscape. Join us for that this coming Wednesday at noon here right in the Iowa City Public Library again to learn about how Jamaica moves to its own drumbeat, making a dance out of its troubles. And with that, again, thank you, Dr. Smith. We appreciate it so much.
Thank you.
And with that, we are adjourned.